top secret. For senior officer. Immediate. Decipher and pass to all relevant sections. 12th of June. Intelligence Insight, number 009.
Welcome to this Bletchley Park Intelligence Insight. The breaking of the German Enigma machine wasn't just down to the codebreakers at Bletchley Park, and didn't start with the outbreak of World War II. It's a story of international cooperation, spanning many years, and who better to tell it than the nephew of Alan Turing. In this, the first of two episodes, we return to 2018, when Bletchley Park hosted representatives of the Polish Embassy in London and families of the Polish codebreakers for the launch of Dermot Turing's book, X, Y, and Z, The Real Story of How Enigma Was Broken. Based on his own original research and newly released documents, both in the book and this exclusively recorded talk, Dermot tells the story of how the French, British, and Polish secret services came together to unravel the secrets of the Enigma machine. He's introduced by His Excellency the Ambassador of the Republic of Poland, Dr. Arkady Zagotsky.
Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. My name's Ian Stand and I'm Chief Executive of the Bletchley Park Trust, and it's my pleasure here to welcome you, particularly those who've been travelling from far and wide to get here today for this important event. We're delighted to welcome you to Bletchley Park for the launch of Dermot Turing's new book, XYZ, The Real Story of How Enigma Was Broken. We're particularly pleased to welcome back to the park His Excellency Dr. Arkady Zagotsky, the Ambassador of the Republic of Poland, who was here, of course, earlier on this year when we opened Hut 11A, just across the way there. And on that subject, please, if you haven't been already, do go to Hut 11A to have a look at the exhibition in there, which includes a full-scale replica of the Polish bomber. Now, Dermot is well known to you, I'm sure, and both as an author and as a trustee of Bletchley Park. And in his new book, he's used newly released documents and his own research to shed new light on the cooperation between Poland, France, Britain, that was so crucial to the Allies in breaking the German Enigma cipher. This afternoon, we'll hear more about the book and have a panel discussion about these important international relationships. So without further ado, thank you once again for coming, and I very much hope you'll enjoy the afternoon. And it's now my great pleasure to ask Dr. Arkady Zagotsky to come and say a few words.
The chairman, distinguished guests, families of the Polish codebreakers, friends of Poland and friends of Britain, dear Dermot, I could not be more proud to return to Bletchley Park to celebrate yet again an important role that the Polish scientist played in describing the Enigma code, which, as we all know, proved crucial in securing the Allies' victory over Nazi Germany. In March, I was privileged to be here when His Royal Highness, the Duke of Kent, ceremonially opened the exhibition about Bomba, as it was mentioned. That explains how messages encrypted on Enigma cipher machine were broken using novel machine techniques. Significantly, thanks to the joint efforts of the Bletchley Park, Polish Embassy and others, among the exhibits on the display, we can now enjoy the replica of Rejewski Bomba, which played a very important role in this time. Today, we gather here together with the families of the Polish scientists, including the daughter of Marian Rejewski, Miss Janina Sylwestrzak, as well as relatives of Jerzy Różycki and Henryk Zygalski, to celebrate a very significant book by Sir Dermot Turing, XYZ, The Real Story of How Enigma Was Broken. Dear Dermot, I want to express my gratitude and appreciation for your tremendous work. It's truly admirable that you, as Alan Turing's nephew, have been able to openly point out the role of the Polish School of Mathematicians, such as Rejewski's theory of Bomba and Zygalski's sheets. It makes me truly happy that, thanks to your book, efforts of other scholars, as well as Bletchley Park, other institutions, families of the cryptographers, the media, and many other individuals, the Polish scientists will finally get the recognition they deserve, not only in Britain, but also worldwide. In fact, your book is very important not only for the past, not only for these people who are interested in history, especially history of World War II, but also, in my opinion, your book is crucial for our future cooperation, for future cooperation, for future friendship. So that's why I would like to thank you all people who gather here, and have a very good meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Wasze Excellencio, Panie, Panowie, Dzień dobry. Dziękuję za przybycie. Dziękuję. I think that's about the total amount of Polish you're going to get from me this afternoon, but thank you for your patience while I said those words. Okay, I'm going to begin this story at the beginning. And the beginning is a long time ago. The beginning is probably 100 years ago. It's 100 years ago this year that Poland emerged from vassalage when its country was split into three parts. And so let me spend just a minute or two for the British audience here just to explain how that is. In 1914, the German Empire was occupying a big part of Western Poland. The Austrian Empire was occupying southern and southwestern, southeastern Poland, and the Tsarist Empire was occupying the territory to the east. Then there was the bit in the middle. For some chunk of the 19th century, that was called the Kingdom of Poland. But it wasn't really an independent Poland because the King of Poland was none other than the Tsar of Russia. And World War I gave, by the defeat, number one of the Tsarist Empire and number two of the Austro-Hungarians and finally the Germans in 1918, gave Poland an opportunity to reemerge as an independent state for the first time in over 100 years. And so that is the shape of the Polish state as it existed between about 1922 and the beginning of World War II. Now, the reason I've shown that on top of the old empire is because I wanted to draw attention to this place. That red arrow points to a town that's in Western Poland called Poznan. Or if you were growing up under the days of the German Empire, Posen. And this is significant because this is the place where the Polish codebreakers learned their trade. And the significance of them learning their trade in Poznan is that any kid who graduated in the mid-1920s had grown up in what was German-speaking Poland. So you spoke Polish at home and you spoke German at school. These boys were bilingual. And this put them in an absolutely prime position for being able to read and understand German-coded messages. It is not irrelevant that they came from there. However, my real story, my story about Enigma, begins with this guy. This is Hans Thilo Schmidt. He won the Iron Cross in the trenches of World War I. And after World War I, he discovered that he wasn't really able, in the troubled economy of post-war Germany, to make enough money to make ends meet. And by making ends meet, I mean funding his aspirational lifestyle of drinking plenty of champagne, having plenty of girlfriends, as well as his wife, having nice clothes to wear, and being able to go clubbing quite a lot. Hans Thilo Schmidt was very fortunate because he had a brother in high places, and his brother in the early 1930s worked for the German cipher office and managed to get Hans Thilo a job. Hans Thilo realized that this job gave him a great opportunity, and one day he walked into the French embassy in Berlin and said, "Could I please speak to the military attaché? I have some stuff that may be of interest to him." They checked him out, and they paid him handsomely, because over the next 10 years, Hans Thilo Schmidt, actually it was the next 9 years, it carried on until after the outbreak of World War II, Hans Thilo Schmidt constantly fed a priceless supply of top quality intelligence documents to French intelligence. And amongst his first haul, his very first haul was some stuff about Enigma. But I need just to fill you in on a little bit more detail first. I need to introduce you to this guy. Okay, this is a convicted fraudster, a card sharper, a man of many nationalities and more names than you could possibly imagine. He was born Rudolf Stallmann, German. By the time we meet him, he changed his name to Rudolf Lemoine because he'd been convicted of trafficking passports, spying in Spain. I mean, you name it. He's guilty of everything. He's absolutely the perfect guy to be hired by French intelligence because he's bilingual and he can look into the soul of any spy he's interviewing. Imagine being interviewed by that pair of eyes. Hans Thilo Schmidt was vetted by this gentleman on the left, who we shall now call Codename Rex. And Codename Rex said, "I think he's the real deal." So it's Rex that brought in Schmidt, Rex that paid the 5,000 Reichmarks a delivery, and it's Rex that managed to secure the meeting between Hans Thilo Schmidt and somebody I'll introduce you to in a second, Gustave Bertrand, in the hotel of a small town in Belgium called Verviers. And at this hotel, Gustave Bertrand was sent upstairs with the documents while Schmidt and Rex drank brandy downstairs. Bertrand is sent into the room they'd hired. And of course, the only room that's dark enough to do photography is the bathroom. So good old Bertrand with his camera is taking photographs of the documents that Schmidt has lifted from the safe of his brother's code-breaking office. And amongst those documents are the operating manuals, including photographs of the Enigma machine. But back in 1932, nobody in British, French, or Polish intelligence had seen a German military Enigma machine. This stuff was gold dust. Now, I must tell a personal story about my own research here, because that photograph there of that Enigma machine, that's a photo of a photo that's in some recently released documents that were in the French archives and were only declassified 3 years ago. And they turned over all these things to be available for the public to use as research material. And so I'm going through these files, and then I suddenly realise that what I'm looking at is the photographs, the original photographs that were taken by Gustave Bertrand in that bathroom all those years ago. And so that picture just sort of made a little bit of a tingle go through the spine. It's just an ordinary photo of an ordinary Enigma machine, but kind of, okay, right. So let me introduce you to Gustave Bertrand, because he's a key character running through the story here. He's not a code breaker. He's an intelligence officer in the cipher department of French military intelligence. But his role, rather than being a code breaker, he's a liaison man. He's the one who not only had these meetings with Schmidt and took photographs of his documents, but he is also the fixer. He's the person who puts people in touch with each other. He's basically not a code breaker, he's a code broker. What his job is to get codes in from people, pay for them, and then sell them on to another higher bidder. And he's very good at his job. He gets hold of these Enigma documents and he gives them to his colleagues in the cipher department in French intelligence. And he says, "Look, we've got this Enigma stuff. Isn't that fantastic?" And they say, "Well, not really, Gustave. We can't really do anything with this stuff because unless you know what the wiring of the machine is, this stuff you've given us is completely useless." He says, "I know. I'll talk to those snotty folks over the channel." So he phones up his colleague, John Tiltman, who works for the Government Code and Cipher School. They've met once before. They were talking about Russian problems. Yeah, people continue to talk about Russian problems. I don't know. They were talking about Russian problems. And so he says to Tiltman, "I got some stuff." Unfortunately, it seems that probably Tiltman didn't get the stuff. It ended up in the wrong hands on this side of the channel. And the reaction from the Brits was, "Well, it's all very well you sending us these sort of instruction manuals and so forth, but if we don't know the wiring of the machine, then how are we supposed to make any progress with it?" So they sent the stuff back. Bertrand had a third card up his sleeve. He had been forming a relationship with a guy called Guido Langer, who was the head of the Polish Cipher Bureau. And so he got on the train and went to Warsaw. And Langer said, hey, this is amazing. This is fantastic. This is gold dust. This is what we've been waiting for all these years. So the reaction could not have been more distinct from what he'd had from his own colleagues and from the Brits. And this is where it becomes very significant, because the Poles have been thinking about the Enigma problem for some years. They've been intercepting these coded messages and not really knowing quite what it was that they could do about them. And they've been putting team after team of mathematicians and code-breaking experts on it, and they really hadn't been getting anywhere until they come across this guy. And I'm very delighted to say that this guy and his wife, who you can see in this picture, I have their daughter in the audience with us today, so we're very privileged to do that. This is Marion Rejewski, whose daughter is here today. Marion Rejewski was given these photographs of these documents that had been photographed in the bathroom. He was given an old commercial Enigma machine, and he was given a pile of intercepts. And based on that material alone, he was able to come up with some equations, and he solved the equations, and through that piece of pure mathematical analysis, he was able to reconstruct the wiring inside the Enigma machine and the wiring of two of the three rotors. That, I put it to you, he said in his best lawyerly tone, I put it to you, is one of the most amazing achievements of 20th century cryptanalysis. It's right up there with anything that was done with Bletchley Park. It probably surpasses a great deal of what was done at Bletchley Park. That guy was amazing. Okay, it's all very well to know what the wiring of the Enigma machine is and the wiring of the rotors. It does not tell you how the Germans are setting their machine up every day. If you don't know how the Germans are setting their machine up every day, you won't read a single enciphered message. So next step that the Poles had to do was to build some Enigma machines that they could work on. You can't just go and knock on the German front door and say, excuse me, have you got any surplus Enigma machines that you're willing to sell? You know, you can't pick them up on eBay. So Antoni Palut was essentially the number one engineering genius within the Polish Cipher Bureau, and he reconstructed an Enigma machine, an example of which you can see on the right-hand side of the page, and that's a photograph of a machine that's here in the UK, actually. It's in the Józef Pilsudski Institute in London, and if you look carefully, it's not quite an Enigma machine, is it? You probably can't see from where you're sitting, but the keyboard is wrong. It's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, not Q, W, E, R, T, Z, like a German one. The plug board is at the back. And there's a number of other technical differences, but it's functionally exactly the same thing. This is the reverse-engineered machine as described by Rejewski following his mathematical analysis and as produced in Palut's factory, where they churned out these fake Enigma machines by the dozen. Fine, that's step one. Step two is to find techniques for finding out how the Germans have set their machine up every day, because they're not going to tell you. So I need to introduce you to two more code breakers. Again, we're privileged to have members of their families here today. We have Jerzy Rzeczycki, and I think he was probably the hybrid between somebody who could think as an electromechanical engineer and also as a code breaker. And he's responsible for designing many of the mechanical devices invented by the Poles for finding the solution to how the Germans had set their machine up. I can't prove it, but I believe he's the brains behind the bomber that you can see in the Hut 11A exhibition. He's certainly the brains behind the cyclometer. If you want explanations of those, let's leave it to the Q&A session, because we'll be here all afternoon. Otherwise, I'll never get to the next slide, which is sexy. Okay, talking of sexy things, I also want to introduce you to Henryk Zygalski. Again, I've got members of his family in the audience, and you'll find out why he's sexy in a minute. He is one of the unsung heroes of Polish code-breaking. He invented the Zygalski perforated sheets method for finding the Enigma settings. His technique was the only technique that was in use in the first few months of 1940, before the Turing-Welshman bomb had come into operation here at Bletchley Park. And this was the technique that they were using to find out what the Germans were saying to each other right up until and into the Battle of France. And I mean, just as an aside, both the Polish and the French code breakers are on record as saying they were being given this priceless information through the Enigma messages they could read. They knew exactly when the Germans were going to bomb airfields around Paris during the Battle of France. And unfortunately, the French general staff didn't believe this crazy thing called signals intelligence and did nothing with the information they were given. The code breakers are in complete despair. This guy is amazing. I can guarantee you've never heard of this guy. And he is at the heart of the liaison which was created between the French, the Poles, and the Brits. So far in my story, the Brits faded out of the story in 1932 when they were offered the Bathroom documents and said they couldn't make anything of them. For most of the 1930s, British intelligence was focused on the threat of the Bolsheviks. They wanted to make sure that the Royal Navy was not under threat from the Russian Navy, and that was the number one priority of British intelligence. It was very late in the day that British intelligence woke up to the fact that there were these things called Nazis around and they might not be very pleasant. This guy, he's Royal Navy man, you can tell. He's called Biffy Dunderdale. In fact, his first name's Wilfred, but they called him Biffy because he was a boxer and you didn't want to have Biffy thump you because you probably wouldn't wake up until tomorrow. Biffy Dunderdale worked for MI6. Biffy Dunderdale was the White Russian liaison man posted by MI6 to Paris, because he spoke fluent Russian, to liaise between the White Russians and MI6. By the time you get to the early 1930s, any White Russians that were still around were all in exile in France. So that's why he was there. But then he was given a new role, which was to be the liaison with the French. And over a period of months and a little bit of coaxing and a little bit of nudging, Dunderdale is encouraged to form a relationship between the Government Code and Cipher School and MI6 on the one hand, and Gustave Bertrand and his essentially market for codes and ciphers on the other. And it's because Dunderdale managed to build up some confidence on both sides of the channel that we were able to bring about some meetings, the first of which took place in January 1939, between the Poles, the French, and the British, all three groups of codebreakers in one room. You will all recognise this gentleman because he is the head of the Government Code and Cipher School, Alistair Denniston. His office is just across the corridor, so if you haven't been there and signed the Official Secrets Act yet, please remember to do that on your way out. Alistair Denniston, head of GCNCS, is obviously the right man to go to the meeting with the Poles and the French. He needs to take his chief cryptographer with him, and that's Dilly Knox. This may have been a stroke of genius. It may have been the biggest diplomatic disaster ever to take Knox. Knox is a classic professor type, and as a classic professor type, he does not accept that anybody is better at his trade than he is. This is very interesting because the Poles don't say anything about their discoveries. They don't say anything about what Rejewski has done. They don't say anything about the bomber, the cyclometer, the Zygalski sheets, any of the other things they've done. The Brits are still struggling with, well, we know there's this Enigma machine. We've never seen a German military Enigma machine. We see that there's this funny attachment on the front. It looks like a plugboard. We don't really know what it does. We've no idea how the Germans actually use it. And we certainly don't know what the internal wiring is. You know, if we knew that, then we'd be able to work out what the wiring on the rotors was. But we still don't know the answer to any of those questions yet. Knox knows about this. Knox has been working on Enigma problems for 3 or 4 years. He's solved the Spanish Civil War Enigma. Knox knows Enigma inside out. But the Poles, despite the snootiness of Knox, figure out that Knox actually knows what he's talking about. They don't tell him anything, but they figure out that he's the guy. He is the guy on the British side. So nothing much has happened at that January 1939 meeting. Nobody's really told anybody anything. It's all in the metadata. It's about, does this guy know? What does he know? Is he any good? It's that kind of thing. Bertrand sees a little bit more in that. He sees that this meeting has been of great significance, and he comes out with this memo immediately after the meeting. What it says is it's a note for Y. What's he on about? Very secret. Note for Y. It says, for greater convenience and, of course, for security, we propose to use from now on the following abbreviations. X equals Paris, Y equals London, and Z equals Warsaw. And he says, and please could you number all your memos as well, because that helps us keep track of them a bit better. But this is the point. What he's done is he's actually created a triangular intelligence sharing network between the three countries. From this moment onwards, memos start to flow between the three countries. And typically what's happening is that the Brits will ask a question and they channel it through the French, because the French are the brokers. And what will happen is that the Polish codebreakers will come back with a memo. It's usually written in German, because that was the language common to all three countries. The Brits didn't speak a word of Polish. The Poles didn't speak a great deal of English, but everybody spoke German. And so you'd find that there were these memos. This one's already number 211 in the series, and a lot of them are admin-y kinds of things like this is, but lots of them have got real substance to them. There's real meat. Nothing about Enigma, none of those questions being answered yet. There's lots of other code and cipher problems that they're working on. So this is where it begins. It begins after that January 1939 meeting. We've set up this liaison, this network. And they also say one other thing. The Poles said, if there's anything that comes up, we'll let you know. If there's anything new, we'll send you a message. In July 1939, Gustave Bertrand sent a message to Denniston of the government's code and cipher school, which said, Il y a du nouveau. There's something new. Something's come up. And that meant that was a summons to reconvene the XYZ triangular meeting. Denniston didn't want to go. He wanted to trek all the way to Warsaw. Knox absolutely didn't want to go to see those fatuous French and those idiot Poles. He absolutely didn't want to do that. And Denniston was going to send somebody else. And he thought, no, I've got to go myself because Knox is so badly behaved that he needs a minder. And true enough, they get into the meeting and the Poles say, OK, cards on the table. We're going to tell you everything that we know. And they started telling the British and the French everything they knew. They told them how the Enigma machine was wired. They told them how the rotors were wired. They told them that tomorrow we'll show you all the machinery we have built that actually finds the settings that the Germans are using every day on the Enigma machines. Knox is furious. He throws all his toys out of the cot and he goes back to his hotel. Okay, so there's Denniston and Knox and they're in hotel rooms in the same hotel. If you want to have a post-mortem on the meeting you've just been to all day, don't you kind of go to the bar and say, God, you know, something's gone wrong here? No. Knox, who is completely furious, sits at his desk in his hotel room and he fires off this letter, which is addressed to Denniston, who's in the next door room. I'm delighted that he did that because it's a paper record and it's in the National Archives, so you can go and see it. And it's, my dear Alistair, let's get this straight. A, the Poles have got the machine to September the 15th, 38, out by luck, blah, blah, blah. And it goes on like this. And it's sort of like, it can't be true. He's completely furious. He's been out-professored by Polish people. Oh, fortunately, I don't know, there must have been something. There's something cathartic about him writing this letter because the next day, having nearly completely ruined this whole meeting by his sort of steaming bad temper on day one. The next day, he's calmed down and he's charming and sweet and open to new ideas and finds the whole stuff, the machinery they're showing him, finds it absolutely fascinating and makes good relationships with Rievsky and Zygalski in particular. And so, oddly, it's all very harmonious the next day. And Denniston comes back to London with the piece of paper on the right-hand side of the slide in his pocket, which is a list of 17 priceless pieces of intelligence. Okay, you can see once again it's in German because it's the lingua franca. But he's been told all sorts of things about how the Enigma works and how to find the settings on a daily basis using these modern techniques like the bomber and Zygalski sheets. Zygalski sheets is number 16, das Netzverfahren, and 15 is die Bomben. You know, so it's all in German, but it's all there. This meeting took place in July 1939. Within 6 weeks, Poland had been invaded. Within 6 weeks, Warsaw had been taken over. Polish codebreakers had to flee. And this gentleman, actually, some of you in the audience may not think he's a gentleman. This gentleman is having a victory parade in the Saxon Square in the center of Warsaw. And I love this photograph, not because it's got Hitler in it, but because Hitler doesn't have a clue that in a building behind him is where Marian Rejewski had reverse engineered the Enigma machine. So where do the Poles go? It sounds like it's the end of the story. They've handed over all the know-how to Bletchley Park, who are then busy working on the engineering design for the Turing Welshman bomb, this amazing machine, which obviously became a war winner in its own way. So what's happened to the Poles? They escaped from Poland, and there's a lot of harrowing stories about how they managed to escape from the invading Germans. And then after the 17th of September 1939, you Brits, you've forgotten this piece of history. Poland got invaded by the Soviet Union as well. So they were escaping from the Russians as well as the Germans. They escaped, eventually finding themselves in France, working for Gustave Bertrand in the Chateau de Vignolles just outside Paris. So they were working in this place, and as I say, this is the heyday of the XYZ cooperation, where using Zygalski sheets, the three countries working together were able to find out what the German military machine was thinking. From a personal perspective, that is the peak from where the XYZ thing comes downhill after that. But I wanted to find out what happened to the Polish code breakers. In particular, there's a myth floating around there that somehow they'd applied to join the team at Bletchley Park and been turned away. Couldn't be further from the truth. There's a bunch of documents in the National Archives where Denniston is saying, can I have these guys? He can't spell their names, but it's clear enough. He's going, okay, British people and Polish language, it's kind of a challenge. But he wants them. He's asked for them. And he's asking Bertrand's boss to hand over these three Polish codebreakers, having discovered they've turned up in France. But by that stage, they're being paid for by and have become thoroughly integrated into the French intelligence machine. Bertrand is not going to let them go. But what about after the fall of France? What happened when Germany invaded France? Again, Bertrand sneaks the Polish codebreakers onto an aeroplane and whisks them off to North Africa. And so they still don't get to Bletchley Park. And then there's a big saga around that. But ultimately, it ends up with the Poles being put in a secret location in the south of France where they are working clandestinely. And this is really very difficult to understand. First of all, they're paid for by the Vichy government. The Vichy government is technically still at war with Germany, even though there's an armistice. The Vichy government knows that its true enemy is Britain because they know that the British, being imperially minded folks, are going to seize all their colonies from them. And so the whole relationship about what the Vichy government think its intelligence targets are, it's a very difficult question. Into this mess, it's actually quite easy to hide a team of Polish codebreakers who are still breaking German codes. They're looking at what the Russians are up to, because the Russians have still invaded their country. And they're placed at the Chateau des Fous. It's just outside a small town in the south of France called Uzès. Uzès is in a very charming bit of sort of Côte d'Rhône area, wine-growing country. It's near all the Roman ruins, you know, the Pont du Gard and all the Roman temple at Nîmes and the Pope's Palace at Avignon. It's touristville. It's beautiful. And it's a long way from anywhere, which is a good thing if you're trying to hide a team of Polish codebreakers. Anna Zygalska-Cannon has got the most amazing library of photographs which document the lives of the Polish codebreakers from about 1940 through to the end of the war. She's got about 200 photographs, and it was a great privilege to be able to have a look at these and to be able to show some of them to you today, because they bring the lives of people who you might think of in terms of squared paper and pencils and dust into sort of a three-dimensional, colourful kind of way. So I've got, top right, I've got Gustave Bertrand with his wife sitting on a jar. He's in charge. She's actually really in charge, but kind of we knew that. Down bottom left, I've got codebreakers playing football. So on the left, I can identify Anthony Pallott, who is apparently in goal. And at centre forward, so second from right, I've got Henrik Zygalski playing football in his spectacles. You can see they're all wearing their suits to play football. I like that. There is another photograph in Mrs. Zygalska-Cannon's archive which shows the victorious team. So they're sitting there properly posed with the football, in the centre. I am sorry to tell you that the Palut-Zygalski team was not the victorious side. Okay, and then we got this rather curious picture of a teenage girl sitting in a jar. They were clearly having some kind of weird game to see whether you could actually hide in a jar. And there was a contest, I think, with the code breakers to see whether you could fit a whole code breaker into a jar. This teenage girl quite clearly did it. She ended up, after the war was over, she ended up marrying one of the Polish code breakers who settled in France. And he's one of the chaps in the picture on the right. You can see there's a sort of team photo. There's a bit of a joke going on. Bertrand, who's second from right, I think he's probably the butt of the joke because he's the only one who doesn't appear to be smiling in that one. What I get from these and the other hundreds of photographs is that, yes, there was lots of code breaking and there's lots of hard work. And sometimes it was actually quite hard circumstances. But they also had some fun. They had girlfriends. They had drinking bouts. And they had really bad football.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes.